Okay, this is the 20th class of Derech Hashem, and it's 2 weeks before Pesach, 3 weeks really, feels like two. So we're going to finish up the chapter that we've been in, and then do some things about Pesach too, or even related to Pesach. So we are in section two, chapter two, up to paragraph number seven. So we'll do 7, 8, and 9, Bezrat Hashem. Okay, so we've been talking about reward and punishment and Olam Haba and where people go. So up to number seven, we talked about, back up for a second into six, that sometimes Hashem rewards people in this world, absolutely wicked people He'll reward in this world so that they don't have any reward left for the next world. And also absolutely righteous people, which, of course, we know nobody's absolutely anything, but the very, very mostly righteous and the very, very mostly wicked will be rewarded and or punished in this world so that the opposite is not available, so only the opposite is available to them. So a wicked person might be rewarded in this world so that they will only be punished and then annihilated in the next world, and a righteous person may possibly be rewarded in this world, punished in this world so that they'll only have reward for the next world and not have to go through any of the difficulties in the next world. Okay, so seven. This principle contains another important concept. In the perfected community of the ultimate future, not everyone will attain the same level. So we discussed also that there's an individual level and there's also a perfected community that people join. So the Olam Haba is not for individuals. It is for a community, which we'll develop a drop further now. The highest wisdom determined the lowest level upon which a person can exist and still attain perfection and an attachment of closeness to God. When an individual's deeds bring him up to this minimum level, he can then be a member of this perfected community and delight in God forever. One who does not attain this minimum level, on the other hand, is destined to be cast aside completely and annihilated. Okay, so there is a concept of entering Olam Haba by the skin of your teeth. It's possible. Unlike the jokes that we tell, where everybody's in the same place, and you could just get in by the skin of your teeth, and then everybody is doing kind of the same thing, depending on whatever jokes. I won't tell a joke now, but I'm sure you've heard lots of jokes about the next world. But unlike where everybody goes to the same place, so there is a concept of going there, but within that place there's different levels. And that we've also discussed in jokes, I'm sure. I don't know if we have here, but you have all these stories of, maybe just a quick one, you know, of the lawyer and the rabbi who show up at the pearly gates together. And the rabbi is taken in first and processed, and he's given a bicycle and a condo and a map and shown the way around, and he's pretty happy with it. He feels like, okay, great, I can manage this. But before he pedals away, he hears the lawyer being processed, and the lawyer is given a stretch limo and a huge mansion and lovely grounds and servants to care for him. And the rabbi kind of turns back and says, oh, wait a second. I was a rabbi of a big congregation for many years. I did a lot of chesed, and I learned a lot of Torah, and I taught a lot of Torah. I don't really think it's fair that I should get a bicycle, and he should get a stretch limo. And so the angel turned and said, look, in heaven we have a lot of rabbis, but he's the only lawyer. Right? So, as a lawyer, Tin, I could tell a joke like that, but yeah. Right, so that just has to do with the anti-lawyer joke. However, we do have concepts that there are different stations within Olam Haba. So it turns out that concept, even if it's not in a joke, is rooted in actual Torah thought, that there is a place, not a physical place, you can get into that perfected community by a certain minimum standard. Once you're in it, however, there is not equality among members. The level that one is on will be determined by one's deeds in this world. Let's look back in the text for a minute. God's plan was that man himself should be the complete master of his own good, both in general and in particular. In general, man can therefore not attain good unless he achieves it through his own effort. This is also true, however, of each element of this good, which is only meted out according to the individual's precise deeds. Each individual's ultimate level is therefore the result of his own choice and attainment. The members of the perfected community will therefore be divided into many levels, high and low, great and small. Each individual's level will not be the result of anything other than his own choice, and no one therefore will have any complaint against another. So in the book that I'm looking at, there's a question that the commentator raises. I have the Pathways to the Way of God version with a commentary by Avram Yaakov Katz. And so he asks if this in fact is a world of chesed, if it's true that Olam Chesed Yibaneh, that Hashem built a world of chesed, and it's also the fact that we choose by our own behavior, our own choices that trigger our own behavior, the exact level that we're going to be on. And there's the system of reward and punishment that we trigger when we behave in certain ways. Where's the chesed? Right? What kind of world of chesed? It seems like that's a world of mishpat, right? That you, what you do is what you get. And it doesn't seem like there's chesed. So he answers that there's actually two aspects of chesed in the world that we need to be thinking about. The first is that the very fact that humankind within this world of physicality and all the physicalness that exists around us, that it's possible to elevate oneself even in this plane. So we understand that using the physical is what allows us to connect to the spiritual, but we're just taking that for granted. That is the case. Through the physical, we achieve the spiritual. But the fact that we can, through the physical, achieve the spiritual is a chesed, because that doesn't actually make sense, that we should be able to impact on the spiritual through the physical. Mm-hmm. So we did discuss probably about 2 months ago, I brought a little passage from Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan's book on Immortality, Resurrection, and the Age of the Universe. We talked a little bit about the role of the physical in uniting spiritually disparate entities. So I'll just review that for a minute. If we understand that one of the aspects of the physical world that's different from the spiritual world is that the physical world can be defined in certain ways through space and physical objects, whereas there's no such concept as space in the spiritual world. So that is one way to differentiate between the two worlds. One has a dimension of space and one does not. So if that's the case, then how can we possibly use words like close to or far from when referring to spiritual things? Because there is no space. So you can't use words like close and far if there's no space. So Rabbi Kaplan explains that close to and far from in spiritual terms means resembles or doesn't resemble, is like or isn't like. But how could, let's say, the soul of man get close to Hashem in the spiritual world? They are so far apart. How is it possible for mankind, for human souls, to get close to Hashem? So it can't really happen in the spiritual world, because there is nothing that can push it together. But in the physical world, opposites can be forced together through pressure. You can just push hard, and two things that are distant can be next to each other, can be close to each other. Mm-hmm. So Hashem created, part of the reason why Hashem created the physical world, and mitzvot, is so that in the physical we could be united. So that when Hashem creates a mitzvah, so he casts his intention, so to speak, into a physical action, do this, and then we engage in that physical action using our bodies, but it holds our souls, and our souls are the ones that initiate the behavior, then that causes Hashem's energy and our energy to be united in that physicality, which then allows our soul to resemble Hashem and then causes us to be closer in the heavenly realms. So the fact that physicality can be used to achieve spirituality is itself a chesed. So that's number one. And number two is the chesed of tshuva, that even though there is a level of mishpat for sure, that what we do, there's required results from the consequences of our behavior, but Hashem allows there to be time between action and consequence, so that we have time for tshuva in there. And also, Hashem allows tshuva to actually erase the past. It's not just Hashem forgives us and the past is still there. We can actually hit the delete button on something that we did, and it doesn't exist anymore if we do proper tshuva. So that's also a chesed. okay. So then we're seeing now that the members of the perfected community will be on all different levels. Okay, number 8. Any questions up to here so far?
No, that's good.
Okay, great. Number 8. This principle contains another important concept involving how one's deeds are judged to correctly ascertain their effects in determining his level in the perfected community. Every deed is judged as to whether or not it should benefit the individual status in this community, as well as to the extent to which it should do so. So if in the past, I think at least I have, or many of us think of ourselves as individuals within Olam Haba. But what this number 8 is coming to say is that everything that we do in this world is not only affects our level, but affects our status within that community, and also how much it's going to affect our status. So there will be certain deeds which, according to the fair and precise highest judgment, should not provide the individual any benefit whatsoever in the ultimate future, but should rather be rewarded in this world. An individual whose deeds are judged in this manner will receive the reward for his deeds in this world and then remain permanently inferior among the lowest, in a permanently inferior state among the lowest of the perfected community. So this next part we'll just do outside. So what he's saying here is that like a person might be rewarded for his good deeds in this world if they're a Rasha, and therefore then have no good left over for the next world, so they would just go to annihilation or go through a painful, lengthy process of annihilation so that they do get recompense for their negativity. Just like that, even a good person or a Beinoni person might possibly have some good deeds rewarded in this world because the overall balance of their behavior has made it so that they should only achieve a certain status in the next world, in the perfected community. But if all their deeds were judged by themselves rather than by status, they might achieve a status that's actually higher than Hashem intends for them. And so therefore, they may be rewarded for some of their good deeds in this world so that those good deeds will not affect the ultimate status of the person in the next world, because they need to be kept on a certain lower level because of the balance of everything. That's all very complicated calculations that only Hashem can make. But it is possible, just looking at the last paragraph then in number 8, so even those individuals' deeds would normally result in their having a higher level in the perfected community. Well, this is so, even though those individual deeds would normally result in their having a higher level. But they are rewarded in this world, judged and rewarded in this world, preventing them from attaining that level. Because for whatever reason, it's just letting you know that it's a very complicated calculation. So it's not just each deed has its merits, and if you add all the merits together, that equals the level that you'll be in that world. It's much more complicated than that. So that's what 8 is letting us know. The math is much more complicated, and it's possible that even a good person, you don't have to be, basically what's coming to say is, you don't have to be a Rasha to be rewarded in this world for some of the good things that you did. It's possible that as a Beinoni, one might be actually rewarded in this world so that you won't achieve a higher level than you're supposed to in the next world. Okay, so number 9, finishing off this chapter. According to everything discussed in this section, we can understand why the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper. In addition, we see how spiritual punishments are also a part of the preparation for the ultimate true reward. Spiritual punishments here is referring to Gehenna, that would help excise negativity even on the other side of the dividing line after somebody's passed away, would be able to take away negativity if they didn't take it away themselves through tshuva or through suffering in this world.
Mm-hmm.
The good that the righteous attain in this world, however, involves a completely different concept, and this will be discussed presently. So here he's addressing the concern that one may have You know, most of us think of ourselves as Beinoniim, or the middle types of people, not Tzaddikim and not Rashaim. And many of us have very good things that are happening in our lives. Uh-oh, are we some of those Beinoniim that are being rewarded in this world? It could make us nervous. So what he wants to explain, and he's just telling us here that in the next chapter he'll start that, the good that the righteous attain in this world, however, involves a completely different concept, and this will be discussed presently. Everything that we've discussed in this chapter deals with the second aspect discussed in the chapter's beginning, namely the preparation of humanity as a whole for the future world. That which involves individuals, however, entails a completely different approach, and this will be the subject of the next chapter. So just for a very quick review of this subject, man in this world, so we have a concept of all humanity to the extent that all humanity is capable and to the extent that each individual participates in the plan. But in general, all humanity is destined to form a community in Olam Haba, those people who merit to be part of that perfected permanent community. Those people who don't will be annihilated. Excuse me. We are completely in charge of whether we'll be a part of that or not. Every single individual has free will and is capable of making decisions that will bring them into that perfected community or take them out of it. We said earlier, and I still haven't clarified exactly how this works for non-Jews, but a basic concept is that Jews are born with a chelek in Olam Haba, but through their choices they could lose it, chas v'shalom. And non-Jews are not born with a chelek, but through their choices they can earn it. So that's the basic understanding. Hi, who just joined us?
Hi, it's Sari Garfinkel.
Oh, great. You came in the perfect time.
Oh, okay, good.
And we're just wrapping up this chapter, and we're going to start some Pesach ideas. So you'll get some Pesach thoughts. Okay, so I just want to give one more sentence then for the wrap-up, and that is that just to review, in terms of removing negativity for a judgment, for the sake of judgment, there's three different options for removing it. The first is tshuva, which we have total control over. The second is suffering, which Hashem provides for us. And the third is Gehenna, which Hashem also provides. So we'll talk more about that as we go further. But basically, that's the end of this chapter, talking about how individuals will create a perfected community in Olam Haba, and we'll all have different statuses, but there is a certain minimum level of accomplishment that one has to achieve in order to be part of that community. Once one has achieved that, then their level will be dependent, the level inside that community will be dependent on their individual behavior. Okay, with that said, let's look ahead to preparing for Pesach just a little bit intellectually. So,
interrupt for a moment.
Yeah. For sure.
Just a technical question. Can you remind me how I mute?
Yes, star 6.
Star 6. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
And you unmute the
noisier
same way.
Here. Okay, great.
No
thank
problem.
You.
Sure. Okay, so Pesach is coming, and the first thing that we need to know so that we can get the most out of Pesach is what are we supposed to be getting? What is the energy of Pesach as it approaches? So we understand two different concepts that we want to see. So Pesach is in the month of Nisan, and Rav Hirsch has a whole discussion on how different letters can be interchangeable, and I don't understand it fully, but part that I do understand is that the letters that can be interchanged in words have to do with the groupings about where they are pronounced in the mouth. So there's, I think there's teeth letters, and there's tongue letters, and there's guttural letters. So Nisan, a samech and a tzadi are pronounced in the same place, and they can be interchanged in a word. So our first discusses how Nisan, the month of Nisan, could be pronounced Nitzan. Nitzan as a tzadi means a bud or a blossom, and that teaches us something about the month, that it is the month of spring. It's the month of beginnings of budding and blossoming. So the first energy of Pesach that we're looking at is the energy of newness and of birth. It really is, Pesach really is the birth of the Jewish people. So we have two holidays that we call birthdays. Actually, we don't call Pesach a birthday, but that's what it is. The holiday that we call a birthday is Rosh Hashanah, right? That's the birthday of the world. But we're going to see here, based on a rehearse that I like quite a bit, that that's the birthday of the world, but the birthday of the Jewish people is Pesach. So we have a double birthday, one in Tishrei and one in Nisan. So the first energy of what we're trying to absorb from Pesach is the energy of birth, of newness, of renewal too, but of newness in the first place. And we understand that every holiday that comes doesn't come to commemorate an event that happened, but rather there is a propitious energy in that month that's inherent in the month that caused that event or that allowed that event to happen at that time. And so when we have the holiday again each year, it is marking that time, and that energy exists in that month the same way every year so that we can tap into that energy. So that's why we want to understand the energy of Pesach that we're tapping into. So level one is the energy of newness. That's why Pesach has to be in the spring. Pesach is spring. It's all about newness. And that's why we can see that even our Avos, and we have traditions of our Avos keeping commandments before the Torah was given, but we certainly have a Midrash that discusses Avraham when he received the guests, the Malachim, the angelic guests after he was circumcised. So he offers them matzahs because it was Pesach time. So how at all could you have Pesach before there was even going into Mitzrayim? You're celebrating coming out. So that Midrash and the fact that he's eating matzah at that time really is a proof in a way. Of course, there's no proofs outside of math, but it's a something that backs up the concept that it's matzah is not about that we had to leave quickly. Matzah is about the energy of eternity and of newness and birth that existed at the time, even without the story of the Exodus. And that's why he was eating matzah then, not to allude to a future Exodus, but to tap to eat the thing that taps into the concept of newness. So that's energy number one. Newness, birth, renewal is all there in Nisan. But the second energy is in the word, Pesach. So you have to ask, what's with the word Pesach? Why is this holiday called Passover, which is the translation for Pesach? Right? What? Why? So this is a David Foreman question, and Rabbi David Foreman. And he says, look, it doesn't make any sense that the holiday should be called Passover. Yes, everybody can answer the standard answer. It's because the angel of death passed over our houses and didn't kill our firstborn. Okay, great. But that's not actually, that's true. And that's why it's called, that's one reason why it's called Passover, but it can't be the reason the whole holiday is called Pesach. It's just like it can't be that we Jews are called Ivriim, are called after Avram and Sarah were called Ivri because they came from the other side of the Jordan River. Right? It can't be that we're all called Ivri, other siders, because of the geographic location from which Avram and Sarah came. There must be some deeper meaning in the word Ivri, and there is. It means we come from the other side of the opinion of the whole world. We are other-siders. There's a deeper nature in other-sideness, and that's why we're called that. So with passing over, too, there must be something deeper, and that's what we want to access. It's not just that the angel of death passed over our homes, but there's got to be a deeper energy of passing over, and that's the energy that we can tap into also when we get to this Yontif. So that energy is the fact that Hashem passed over our readiness to be redeemed. He passed over all prerequisites. So there is an energy of accomplishing spiritual heights without putting in the necessary prerequisite energy to achieve that height that's inherent in the month of Nisan and inherent in Pesach, that our prerequisites can be passed over. It doesn't mean that, of course, we have to rebuild underneath it, but we can jump high and achieve heights on the Seder night and during Yontif. We can achieve a lot without the necessary prerequisites. And then Sfiras Omer is when we build the foundation underneath it. But we do have the ability to accomplish a lot for Pesach. So we want to know that so that we can grab that energy and run with it. So that's the initial energy that we want to look at for Pesach, the energy of newness and the energy of jumping over prerequisites and accomplishing a lot. So this is Chag HaEmunah. It's the it's a holiday of where we build emunah in ourselves, and that emunah is based on past experience, right? So that it's not just blind faith. Yes, something's going to happen in the future, but because we've had regular interactions with Hashem in the past, and He's made promises and kept them, we trust Hashem to keep a future promise. And Pesach is, the exodus from Egypt, is one of the primary promises He made and kept, because we were redeemed only because of the promise, not because we earned it and not because we deserved it on our own merit, but because Hashem promised. And so He took us out based on the promise. And therefore, we know that the future redemption is going to happen for sure, also, based on the fact that Hashem promised. So in the light of that, it's possible that people might get lazy and say, look, you know, the world's going to be redeemed. Humanity's going to be redeemed. The Jews will lead the way in that redemption. So it doesn't really matter what I, individual person, does, because anyway, it's going to happen, right? Just like we just read in the Megillah, where Mordechai is telling Esther, Esther, whatever you choose, it doesn't actually matter. The Jews will be saved. You just choose what role you'd like to play in that. But for sure, we're going to be saved. So we have this promise also. The whole world is going to come to perfection. The Jews will lead the way in that happening. So we might say to ourselves, so what does it matter what I do? If I'm in Kiruv, if I'm not in Kiruv, if I'm observant, if I'm not observant. In the end, the whole thing is going to get to the right place, which is true. It is true. In the end, the whole thing is going to get to the right place. Hashem promised, and that's going to happen. Still, we get to write our role in that. And in light of what we just learned in Derech Hashem, it absolutely matters. It doesn't matter what we do in terms of if the world's going to get there or not. But it sure matters what we do if we're going to get there or not. Right? If we're going to be part of that perfected community, and what level we're going to be on for eternity within that community, that's completely dependent on every single choice that we make, positive and negative. So whether the world gets there, that's Hashem's job. What role we play in it, that's our job, and we get to pick. So that's a part of what we need to know, is that we get to choose what role we'd like to play, and we can take that leap and jump over all prerequisites Seder night and set a goal of a spiritual height we'd like to accomplish. Let's think for a minute about what Rav Hirsch says about 2 days and 2 years. So we have two different ways of counting time. And it's a fascinating thing. I'm taking this from the Hirsch Chumash, in Shmot Yud Bet, Pasuk Bet, which is the Pasuk that we're going to be reading this Shabbos in Parshas HaChodesh, where it says, "Achodesh hazeh lechem rosh chodeshim, rishon hu lechem lechodshei hashana." This month shall be to you the first of months. It shall be the first month. It shall be to you the first of, let me translate it the way Rav Hirsch does it. "The renewal of the moon shall be unto you the beginning of the new moons. It shall be unto you the first of the months of the year." So it's tricky actually to translate it, because really there's two different halachas in here, really two different concepts. So I want to share with you what Rav Hirsch says about it. It's the first thing is that this is, it's interesting that we read this before Pesach, because it's the fourth of the four parshiot. Each one of those parshiot is there to get us ready in different ways for Pesach, for this newness, for this leap into the future, for accomplishing something. But really, this mitzvah was given after we left. It's the first mitzvah that we got. HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, Rosh Chodeshim, and so the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh is the first mitzvah that we got when we came out of Mitzrayim. But this is the mitzvah that was transformative for us as a people, and it's interesting that this we read this before Pesach now. So let me just read you the one paragraph here, one of many, because it's really, he has like a 5-page-long essay on this, one pasuk. I'll read you one paragraph. "Just as God told Noah to turn his looks away from the earth, which had just been re-given to man, and direct them to heaven, and showing him the rainbow, said, 'Zot ot habrit,' this is to be the sign, the guarantee of my covenant with the new future, which I promised to humanity in the same way in Egypt, at the threshold of the new Jewish future, He called Moses and Aaron to the open, showed them the silver crescent of the new moon, and said, "This renewal is to be to you the beginning of new moons," literally a beginning of renewals or revivals. "And it, the month that is beginning with it, is to be for you the first of the months of the year." There are two mitzvot contained in this verse, Kiddush HaChodesh al-pi Re'iyat HaLevana B'Chidusha, fixing the beginning of the month with the new moon becoming visible, and to make the order of the months of the year start with Nisan, the month of redemption. Now he has a whole long discussion of how the calculations are made, but let's just start with this. So he has a clear, in this long essay, which is definitely worth reading if you have the chance, he says this, what's happening here is he's saying to Moshe and Aaron, this newness that you see in the Shemaim right now, this is to be your new sign. You are the people of the moon. Not that you follow the moon, not that you chas v'shalom worship the moon, but that you follow the example of the moon, constantly renewing yourself, always making things new, a constant reinvention. Never enter the zone of decay, but always stay in a place of constantly growing and renewing. And even though you're going to face difficult times and it's going to seem so dark, you're always going to bounce back. You're always going to start again. Not like the Egyptians, the place that you just came from, that really counts time by the sun, which creates a year, shana, which means repeat. Rather, you should count time by the moon so that you count by months, chodesh, chadash, which means new. Always make yourself new. So in light of that, it talks about the two, and then it's the, and then the second half is, this month shall be to you the first of the months. So Nisan is the first month. Pardon?
No, and my husband was wondering if he could
okay.
I guess I could go. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Nisan is the first month, even though Rosh Hashanah is in the fall. So we have clear psukim in the Torah that say that the year's end and beginning is in the fall with the harvest festival. And we have clear psukim in the Torah that say Nisan is the first month. So how do we reconcile that? And we also have the question as to which time is the birthday of the world. When was the world created? Was it created in Nisan, springtime, newness? Or was it created in Tishrei when we celebrate the birthday of the world? And we say on Rosh Hashanah, this is the birthday of the world. So there is an opinion. There's opinions that say that it was created in Nisan and opinions that say it was created in Tishrei, and there's a resolving opinion that says it was created in potential in Nisan and created in actuality in Tishrei. So that that is when we celebrate the birthday of the world is on Rosh Hashanah. That's the physical creation, and the thought creation was in Nisan. Meanwhile, though, we see that it's two different concepts. So the year of the world is Tishrei to Tishrei, and the year of the Jews is Nisan to Nisan. So the year of the world, let me look at Rav Hirsch's words here. The year of the world, he says it so beautifully, so I just want to see if I can find. The year of the earth with its products, as well as all association and dealings with all goods of the earth, are reckoned from autumn to autumn. Israel's years, the years of its festivals and its princes, count from spring to spring. Here we have an exhortation on our double nature, worked into the logbook of our lives. Everything pertaining to the earth is born bare and without blossom, out of the night. So everything starts in the fall, bare and without blossom. And even though it rises to the brightness of midday and riches of blossom and fruit, sinks bare and blossomless into the night of its grave. Everything holy and Jewish has its origin in light and life. And even though it has to meet and contend in running its course with night and death, out of darkness and death it struggles back to light and life. And what was born out of morn and spring ends again at dawn, rejuvenated to a new spring. So those are his words for the 2 years, but before that he discusses that days are actually timed that way too. We count days from sundown to sundown, so a day starts in the dark, moves into deeper darkness, comes into dawn, has the brilliance of day, but then sinks back into darkness again. And really, when we think about, if you think about evening, that's like the fall. That's before the darkness of winter, right?
Yeah.
So evening and before the darkness of midnight. So our days, the earthly days, are night to night. But in the Beit HaMikdash, days are counted from the morning. So it's dawn to dawn, just like Nisan to Nisan. So holiness is light to light, and physicality is dark to dark. So even though physicality will blossom and bloom, it sinks back into darkness. And even though spirituality will struggle against the darkness, it will blossom back into light and potential. So you have this juxtaposition of the 2 days and the 2 years and how we count that time. And that's part of what we're going to be reading. This Shabbos, Parshas HaChodesh, is about the constant newness that's available to us every single month, not just Pesach time, but every month, every day, actually, we can reinvent ourselves. And that's part of the secret of the Jew, is to constantly be renewing, always striving to grow. Okay, so let's just look for another minute, just another thought about Pesach. In terms of preparing, maybe we'll do a little bit more on Pesach next time, along with the Derech Hashem, but just something to think about in terms of preparing. So Pesach, also, the word itself could mean Pesach. It's a play on words, but it's not quite spelled that way. But Pesach, the mouth that converses, the mouth that speaks. And we know that our mouths is the instrument through which we bring bracha into the world. We bring our intellect and our spirituality into the world through the vehicle of our mouths. We share it with the world. Our koach tefillah and our intellectual ideas are brought to the world through that. But when we went into Mitzrayim, Paro enslaved us so deeply that even our mouths were enslaved. So if you look at the word Paro, which is spelled Pei Resh Ayin Hey, and you take the first and the last letter, so that's Pei. Right, a mouth. And the middle two letters is Ra, an evil mouth. So even in Paro's name, you can see an allusion to the enslavement of our mouths. And it says, it's interesting to think about Rosh Hashanah and Pesach, there's two prayers that are primal prayers that happen. So Rosh Hashanah, we have the shofar blast, which is a prayer that transcends language. Right, we just take breath and bring it through that instrument to create a prayer that is beyond articulation. Right, that bypasses the need for words and just expresses everything above words. But in Mitzrayim, it says that Hashem heard our groaning. Right, that's in a way a prayer below words that we couldn't even articulate ourselves into words at all because our mouths were so enslaved that we couldn't even pray to get out of this mess. All we could do was moan. And Hashem heard our moaning and saw our affliction and took us out. So, but then, if you think about it, the principal avoda of the Seder night is the Haggadah. Use your mouth. Tell the story. Pesach, a mouth that speaks. Speak it out. Speak it out. And the more we speak about it, the more we're praised for that. And so we have these questions and answers, right? Four questions and answers that we give. And it's interesting, Rabbi David Foreman points out that the word answer, ana, and the word inui, affliction, share a root. So what is it, right? Ana is pa'al, the softer version of the root, and ina, inui, affliction is PL, which is the more intensive, like shavar is break and shiber is shatter, right? So we have ana and ina. So ana, answer, and inui, how could affliction be the intensive form of answering? So Rabbi David Foreman explains that a servant or a slave, their whole job is just to answer, never to ask, why should I do this? Only to ask point of information, how do you want this done? But your whole essence is all about answering intensely, that you don't have anything left over to ask. You're just an answerer. But part of freedom is the ability to ask questions and bandy about different answers. And so we have this questions and answers going on at the Seder. So one of the tools then we're supposed to bring, and with this I'll end for tonight just in terms of the preparation, we're supposed to bring our best vessels to the Seder table, our most lovely kalim. So based on some words that I heard from Rav Shlomo Freifeld Zatzal this week, he talks about bringing your most lovely kalim into the sukkah, and that one of the kalim that you should bring is your mouth. And so now I'm just making an extension from his words. For sure, that's true for Pesach too. If the whole concept of the Seder night is the Haggadah, and one of the understandings of the word Pesach is a mouth that speaks, then some of the beautiful kalim that we should be bringing to the Seder table include our mouths. And if part of our preparation for Pesach is koshering our kalim so that we will have them ready for the Seder, we might consider also how can we kosher this kli so that we have the right kli to bring to the Seder table to use for the holy work, for the avoda of the Seder, of the Haggadah. So I was just thinking about koshering our mouths, and when we get a kli ready for Pesach, there's two things that we do. One is Haggalah, right? We dip it in boiling water, which of course we're not going to do to our mouths, but the point of doing that is to purge the negative out. That's what it does. Then after you take it out and dip it in the cold water, so then you want to make it pretty and shiny for the table, you polish it up. So it's really, it's not about the koshering, but it's about getting it ready for the Seder table. How could we get this kli, our mouth, ready for the Seder table? So first we want to purge the negative out, and then we want to polish it up. So I would suggest, or my own personal avoda in koshering my mouth for the right kli for the Seder table, is to work harder on the guarding of my language, you know, that I should make sure that negative things are removed from my speech, purged from my speech. So I'm working hard on being a little more sensitive. Of course, the regular halachas of Shemaras HaLashon too, to not have negative things in my speech, but to be extra sensitive also. And then the polishing up is to actually use my language for good, to compliment a little bit more, to create more shalom, to say hi more often, just to polish up the kli so that it's ready to be a beautiful kli when I bring it to the Seder table. So let's see. So that's a thought, one of the preparations that can be done. Should I have another thought of preparation? Do you have time for that now? Or
yeah.
Both of you let me know. Yeah, okay. So here's one more thought. So preparing our homes, of course, we have long lists on how to do that. But something else that has to be prepared for a very successful Pesach is our hearts. Because Pesach is a very emotional time where families can clash, or where difficulties can happen, or depending on our stages in life, we can feel overburdened. We women can feel overburdened with all the preparations and be short-tempered with people. And I know that I have a lot of family coming, so I was just thinking for my own self, how can I prepare my home and my heart for Pesach? And it's interesting also to think about the juxtaposition of these two Rosh Hashanahs. It's fascinating to think that the Rosh Hashanah of the year, the physical Rosh Hashanah that's in Tishrei, is preceded by a whole month of spiritual work. All Elul is spiritual work for the physical Rosh Hashanah. And the spiritual Rosh Hashanah, Pesach, is preceded by a whole month of physical work, of cleaning out the house, right?
Yeah.
So it's interesting juxtapositions of what we're doing, Erev both Yontifs. So,
yeah.
So the reason why I'm saying that is so that you shouldn't think that you should be spending this entire month meditating and pondering, even though I'm going to give you a short meditation right now, that the real avoda of the month is physical, not spiritual. But within the physicality, there's spiritual work that needs to be done. So we understand that chametz is an illusion. Chametz is something that rises. It's also something that takes time. We have the phrase, mitzvah habaliyadcha al tachmitzena, a mitzvah that comes to your hand, don't let it turn to chametz. So obviously a mitzvah can't be a chametz thing, but what it means is don't let it stay there long enough that it ferments. Don't let it sit around. We have this concept of zrizus, of alacrity. We want to do things quickly, accomplish things right away, because if we do it right away, it can't enter into the decay zone. The zone of tumah is the zone of decay. We want to bring it straight into kedusha, the integration of spiritual and physical, right away. So we have, in addition to the concept of removing chametz from our homes, we have the concept of removing chametz from our hearts. That we want to take away that which is fermented, that which is puffy, that which is prideful. So we want to get our ego out of the way to the extent that it's harmful. There's parts of our ego that are very helpful. Also, we want to keep that intact. But the negative, we want to get rid of. So we want to take some crumbs out of our hearts as well as we're taking the crumbs out of the house. So I was thinking about our hearts. We have four chambers in our hearts. So for my own self, I was doing just a breathing exercise based on some work that I learned from Miriam Millhauser Castle in her Inner Torah workshop, which she discusses softening the heart, especially when your heart may seize up a little bit in the face of stressful situations. Let's say, and I'm not going to name any relationships, but there are certain relatives that can ruffle feathers pretty easily, or just people that we know that we might be seeing over Yontif that can make life less comfortable or even uncomfortable. And even sometimes thinking about certain people can make our hearts tighten up, especially if we're trying to be good girls and, you know, and be kind on the outside. We might put the stress on the inside and actually feel a tightening in our hearts. So the softening the heart and creating space there is an exercise that might be helpful beforehand. So for me, I was doing a breathing exercise and imagining the four chambers of my heart. So the first one, I want to clean out, and it took a few breaths to imagine cleaning out that first chamber, taking out the chametz, and creating space for Hashem. Now that's the first concept that I want to introduce. I don't know if I should call it the first one. I guess the first one is the right way to say it, one with a capital O. The first one I want to make space for is Hashem, that just as Hashem made space for me inside of Him, I want to make space for Him inside of me. So I open up that first chamber of my heart and clean it out so there's space for Hashem to come in. And that, I find, is the easiest of the four chambers. The second one is space for family. And that's where a little extra work might be done, where I personally have a relative that, and I just found out a second one is coming that might be a little bit difficult. So I'm actually doing visualization exercises, thinking about those people, imagining them saying some of the things they have said in the past that have been difficult to hear, and feeling what it might feel like when they say that or what it felt like in the past, and softening, creating the space for that not to affect me in a negative way. That I have the space, loving space, for that person. I can take the chametz out and put it by the side. Maybe I'll even think about it burning when I burn the chametz, but the chametz can be removed and there can be space for my family and extended family in that part of my heart, and I can soften up. And I'm actually doing some practicing exercises with those people that can cause difficulty, and it's actually getting a little bit easier. And I don't spend a lot of time, maybe a minute here and there, but it makes a difference. Then the third chamber is space for community, right? So, and that you could decide on your own if that's your immediate community, your neighborhood, your shul, your city, or all of Klal Yisrael, but emptying out the chametz and creating a loving embrace for Klal Yisrael in the third chamber. And the fourth one is space for ourselves, to really create a loving environment for ourselves, and particularly in the light of what we learned, that we could take a huge leap, bless you, into spiritual heights, and that we have, you know, so much that we can accomplish during this season, during Yontif. It's possible that we might turn around with our aspirations in front of us, where we'd like to be. It's possible that we might turn around and look at ourselves where we are and say some not nice things to ourselves. You're not doing what you should be doing. You're not worthy. You're not accomplishing where you should be. All kinds of negative thoughts can be there. You're not as organized as you should be. You're not as good a cook as you'd like to. Whatever it is, we could say that. So to open up space in our heart in that fourth chamber, clean out the chametz, and create a loving space for ourselves to dwell, where we could be embraced for who we are, how we are right now, and keep our aspirations intact, but not think negative thoughts about where we are right now, but to embrace ourselves as we are right now so that we can move forward with positive energy rather than negative energy into Yentif. So those are two extra ways to consider growing during this time when there's so much else to do. We'll have one more class next week before Pesach. We'll do some Derech Hashem and some Pesach ideas, and then Bezrat Hashem will pause for Yentif and continue after that. I'll look forward to talking to you next week.
Thank you very much.
Have a great week. Okay, be well.
Bye-bye.